Tonight we'll have a very special experience, Angie Finnamore.
I like to start by sharing just a little bit about what put me in a state where I would take my life. Otherwise, the near-death experience doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I have one little sister. She's a year and a half younger than I am. We were born in Phoenix, and then my family moved to Tucson when I was just a few years old, and it was idyllic. And then my father took a transfer to Las Vegas, and that was when really pandemonium hit. My mother suffered from severe phobias, and she took some classes at UNLV by a psychologist who has since done time, by the way, and he operated a experimental psychological retreat deep in the recesses of Bryce Canyon, and he told my mother that she should go, that it would make a difference for her phobias, and it would last a summer. And there was no communicating, no writing, no calling. There was no electricity anyway, and it was a 5-mile hike in. Everybody lived in teepees. When we went to go pick up my mother, I was 9, we were informed that she wasn't coming back, that she was going to be there for a year, and I was blown away by the difference in my mother. She was not the same human being. So we went and we visited her quite a bit, my sister and I. There was one particular event. I went over Thanksgiving to visit. There were a lot of children, and horrific stuff was happening to them. And there was this little boy, Petey. He was my age, 9 years old, and he had a lisp, and he was undergoing what they called deprivation therapy. And he was not allowed anything except for one pair of mangy underwear and bread and water once a day. And he couldn't associate with any of the adults, just the children. And his teepee was across the river. So imagine, there's no electricity, and he's 9 years old, that alone, right? And so we were wrapping up, the cowbell rings to come get dinner, and Petey starts begging everybody to please sneak me out some food. And all of the other children know better, and they say no, and they hustle off. And I said, of course, meet me under the cook shack after it gets dark. So I loaded up a plate and met him under the cook shack, and one of the resident children ratted me out to the guru. And the next morning I was called to group therapy and placed front and center on the hot seat. And he said to the group, Angie broke a rule. She fed Petey. We're not going to feed her. And then he looked to my mother, and my mom, I look at her like, are you kidding me? There's this shame and pain that just falls over her face, and she says, that's fine. Well, in that moment, I decided a few things that kind of like directed the rest of my life. One is that my mother doesn't love me, and people are crazy, and God needs some help with this world, and you know what, if he's not going to do anything about this kind of injustice, I am. So at 9 years old, crusader born. So my father was alcoholic, and he went off the deep end when my mother left, and my sister and I were carted to drunken parties and worse, often left to fend for ourselves. He was very loving at the same time, but just completely incapacitated and no business raising two little girls. Then enter my stepmother. Before I go any further, I want you to know I am complete with all of these people. I am complete with my mother. I am complete with my father. There is nothing but love and forgiveness. And not even forgiveness, because it's not even necessary. It's just compassion and thank you for my life. So my stepmother, she suffered from manic depressive disorder, and she attempted suicide 6 times during the 6 years that she was married to my father. She had severe migraines, and I looked just like my mom. She was just very, very angry, and all of that was focused at me. And by the time I was 14 years old, my father was given an ultimatum that he could have his wife or his daughter. That was it. And so I was shuttled off with sympathetic relatives and took my newfound freedom right off the deep end. In one night, was exposed to everything imaginable. Drugs, you name it, alcohol, everything and more. Went home after the summer. I was home for a day and couldn't do it for even 24 hours, and I moved in with another cousin. It was going on Christmas vacation, and this was my 9th grade year, so I'm 14 years old, and I passed out in the hallway during 5th grade after taking PCP. And so I was expelled from school, and my father came to get me, and I went home. So fast forward a bit, I believed when I left my home at 18 years old that was, now I'm free, and now I get to live my real life. And you should know I'm complete with my ex-husband too, okay? Nothing but honor there and appreciation. So I got married, and he had me off the ground by my hair within the first week. And I had no idea how to deal with this. I had a complete loss that God would allow this kind of thing. And then there was this other thing that happened, the Lafferty murders. July 24th, 1984, Dan and Ron Lafferty killed their sister-in-law and her baby, and they claimed that God told them to do this. So I was walking across the street from the courthouse the morning that they were arraigned, and they happened to be being escorted in by an entourage of officers. And I glanced over, and I could feel this darkness just emanating through the street. And I turned and I looked, and Dan Lafferty turned and locked eyes with me, like he could feel me looking. Whatever was inhabiting that man could feel me and knew me. And I'd never felt this kind of darkness, and I know darkness. I knew it was an important moment, but I didn't understand why at the time. But that moment launched me into victim advocacy. After a brutal attack, when I moved to Washington State a couple years later, there was a repeat offender who had served time for killing a little girl. He got a hold of a little 7-year-old boy and mutilated him, and this little boy survived. And I was not okay with that. And I was already watchdog for the planet, right? Underdog, really, with my cape and everything. Like, I'm going to save the world. So there were two coalitions that were formed. I was the president of one, the co-vice chair of another, and we worked in tandem, and we changed the laws governing violent sex offenders in the state of Washington, which became the model for the rest of the country. And we changed the legal landscape for the rest of the country. And what I was hoping from this was my own healing. But what happened was the reverse. I started working with all of these people who'd had terrible things happen to them. Wesley Allen Dodd, I don't know if you remember who he is. He was executed for murdering 3 boys. I knew his father. I knew a woman who was shot in the face in front of her 4-year-old son during a robbery attempt, and he survived this. I can't even speak because we have children in the room. I can't even say the things that happened to some of these people whose battles I went and fought, spent a lot of time in court holding their hands. Once that year came to an end, my husband had joined the military, and we were transferred to Okinawa, Japan. It started to just broil up in me, all of this. And I had resurfaced memories, things that I had forgotten about my childhood, that my father was complicit. I had totally blocked that out. I had that coming up. Plus, what do I do with all of this? Then I also had this cyclical depression that had kicked in. It was about 2 years on this. Every January and June, I would go off the deep end. I would barricade myself in the house. I would behave like somebody I don't even know for about 2 weeks. And then I'd be back to myself, sackcloth and ashes. And I had no idea what was wrong with me. I had sought counseling. Nobody had any answers for me. Nobody had even seen anything like this. So I was right in the middle of one of those, about January 6th, 1991. And I left the house to go get milk in my slippers and my sweats, and I didn't come home for 24 hours. I went to the beach. I went to the BX, which is the equivalent of a Walmart for military, and I bought shampoo and I washed my hair. I went and saw Flatliners. I don't know if you remember that little film. And then I went home. And when I walked in the door, I had 2 children at the time, 2 little boys. I had a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old. And in the book, they are Alex and Jacob. In real life, they are Ricky and Charlie. They are grown adults, and they don't mind having their names out there, but they were children when I wrote the book. Ricky was 5, and Charlie was 2. And I walk in, it's like 10 o'clock at night, and my husband and my 2 boys are kneeling in the living room. And my husband stands up, Richard, and he's white as a sheet. I don't even know what to say. I have no idea how I'm going to explain myself. I've been explaining myself for 2 years at this point. And the next day, Ricky wouldn't talk to me. He stayed in a little ball and just was so angry and just huddling in the corner. Charlie wouldn't let me put him down. So it was that night I decided that I was not going to put my children through this anymore. They were young enough, they'd get over it. That I was a detriment to my family. I had no idea what was wrong with me. I thought maybe I had multiple personality disorder. I had no clue. And then I listened to this song for most of the night. It's the Smiths. I don't remember the name of it, but there's a line, and it goes, "Oh, mother, I can feel the soil falling over my head. The sea wants to take me. The knife wants to slit me. Do you think you can help me?" And I penned a note to my children and my sister and my husband and left my pearl earrings and my wedding ring, and I swallowed an entire prescription. And just about the time that the room was spinning and I could hardly see straight, a lot of it came up. And ironically, I grabbed my son's Easter basket And I didn't get this until later, all the symbolism in this. So then I went and I put on a white dress and I ran a bathtub and I broke apart my safety razor and I got into the tub and I slit my wrist. And which is a hard thing to do, by the way. I don't know how anybody actually follows through with that. But I have these lovely scars. And I'll tell you now, because you're going to wonder the whole time, what is that on her wrist? Those are tattoos. And if I put it together, facing me, it says in Sanskrit, surrender. Like, give myself to God, give myself to life, no matter what the roller coaster looks like. Ride it with my hands in the air. And not like there's anything wrong, it just completes that for me. It's a reminder. You see it when you're driving. You do everything with your hands. Then I got out of the tub, I changed, and I took just about everything in my medicine cabinet. And I took it slowly. I took all the liquids so that I could hold them down. And about 4 or so in the morning, my husband worked. He was in the Air Force, so he was at NORAD. It's a lockdown, you don't come home for lunch kind of thing. So I said goodbye to him. And he asked me, are you okay? And I said, I'm fine. And then my kids woke up. I could hardly move, and I was doing this very, very slowly. And I wrote a note, and I sent them to my neighbor. I said, will you watch them? I'm not feeling well. I laid down on the couch, and it was very shortly after that that I could feel it happening. There was this tremendous vibration, like an F-15 coming down in the backyard. I actually turned to look to see if there was an airplane coming down. This intense, loud, huge vibration. And as I open my eyes, I realize it's happening inside of me, that it's not in the room, it's me. And there's also this whirring noise, this incredibly loud whirring noise. And I realize it's happening. And because my stepmother had had a near-death experience, she had a near-death experience when she had a near-fatal car accident. And she went up to the corner of the emergency room, and she spoke with dead loved ones, and she was told, your life's going to be hard, and you have choice, but you're supposed to go back. And she chose to come back. And she told me about that one time. And even though our relationship was volatile, when she did tell me about this, she goes, I think this is why I was supposed to come back, is to tell you about this experience. This was my understanding of near-death experience. This is back in 1991. I didn't know anything else about near-death experience except for my stepmother's. And so I expected that I was going to go up to the corner of the room to watch. So I'm laying there with my eyes closed, and everything is getting very intense. Color is intense. And I'm seeing what I think is the inside of my eyelids, this yellow membrane, but it's brilliant gold with red capillaries running through. And I open my eyes to go to the corner of the room and watch, and all of a sudden I feel myself surge back into my body. So I'm confused a little bit, so I try it again. I close my eyes, and at this point I realize it requires my will. I have to participate in this. As I close my eyes, I'm surrounded by this yellow membrane again with the red lines running through it. And then I can feel my spirit separating from my body and I want to watch. So I open my eyes and I'm back in my body. So I stopped doing that. I just gave myself over. I submitted to this experience, willed myself dead. And when I did that, I was completely surrounded by this yellow membrane with these red capillaries running through it. My arms were crossed across my chest like this, and I was being squeezed and pushed through this membrane. At the same time, I was having a contraction in my abdomen like I was giving birth. And it wasn't until later that I realized that that was my first memory. I went right into my life review, and it was of being born. The next thing I see, I'm being cradled like this in a woman's hand. And I'm looking up at her, and I look just like my mother, but I'm experiencing everything that's going on over here and everything inside this infant, so I can't tell who I am, whether I'm the infant, like one of my own children, looking up at myself, or if I'm the infant looking at my mother. Then I hear a voice in the room, and my mother starts talking to somebody else. I know it's my father. I can't understand a word they're saying, and I don't care. All I have is this experience of love, euphoria, peace. I want to be here. I'm excited about life, and my mother loves me. That was all I cared about. And then I went into every single moment of my life. I experienced every single moment of my life, all the way until I was laying there on the couch, having taken all those drugs. Some of it was very drawn out. Some of it I experienced long and complete, but I was experiencing it all from everybody's point of view, not just my point of view. I was experiencing it from everybody that I was interacting with, as well as this third-party observer, this apathetic, dead human being that I had become, that I would do that. So I'm watching this happen. I'm experiencing it as a little girl, and I'm experiencing everybody else's interactions with me at the same time. And some of it was just, this isn't important. We're skipping through that. This isn't important. And some of it was very long and drawn out, in particular a birthday party when I was about 5, where I could feel the wrapping paper, and I was just amazed how alive. I hadn't been that alive in so long. So I come all the way to the end, where I'm lying there on the couch. It abruptly stops, and at some point I realized I was also seeing it on a screen in front of me. It comes abruptly to an end. I'm surrounded by darkness. There's a presence next to me, to my left. He's male. I know him intimately. And I know there's love there, but I can't see anybody there. I can just feel him there. And I hear him say, "This is your life. This is the life you lived. No drama, no significance about it. Just that's it." At that time, I knew I was gone. I knew I was dead. And I'd had an uncle that had died in a car accident when I was 11 years old. I'd had a cousin who died when she was 11 years old. And then my grandmother was passed on. And I was excited that I had done this. I was proud of myself that I had done this. And so I looked around for them. And not thinking clearly like where I might be, that they aren't there. And I thought, well, where's my cousin and where's my grandmother? I can get maybe my Uncle Sid not being here. He did not live a stellar life. But my grandmother and my cousin I would expect. So I'm looking for them. And this darkness isn't just absence of light. It's like this palpable material, like this mist. And I can feel it and hear it all at the same time, like it's this kind of creative power that can be gathered and used. So I swing my head to the right because I'm looking for my cousin and my grandmother. And that's when I notice that there's a line of teenagers standing next to me. And there's about 6 of them. I look down like this, and I look at the girl on the end, and she's got this long, stringy blonde hair, just this really slight girl. And she's 16. I know that she's about 16. I think to myself, what in the world could be so bad in her life that she'd take her life? I knew intuitively that they had killed themselves. And so I lean over and I say, "Oh, we must be the suicides." And I'm thinking all of this. But the kid standing next to me, he was a boy, he was tall and thin, he had dyed black hair, black eyeliner, white t-shirt, black leather vest, and like combat boots or Doc Martens, okay? And he hears me. He looks down at me and looks away. And that was when I realized that my thoughts were audible. As soon as I thought this, "We must be the suicides," it wasn't until later I put together that everything that happened was by virtue of me forwarding the experience, by the way, by my choices, by what I was saying, by what I was thinking. So I say, "We must be the suicides," and all of a sudden I am out of there at tremendous speed, standing upright. I don't know how far it was. It could have been the span of the planet, miles and miles, I have no idea, but it was very, very fast. But I didn't have the effect of G-force. And so I traveled through this darkness at tremendous speed, and I see approaching a beltway in front of me that stretches out as far as I can see to the left. It's about 30 feet deep, and it's filled with people, and nobody to the right. And as I approach this, I ask the question, "What is this?" And I hear the word purgatory. I have no idea why. I was not raised Catholic. That was what I heard. As I started to land, I could see that all of these people, and I was told thousands and thousands, they were all in white robes, but they were dirty, filthy. And I had the thought, that's interesting, because I would have thought that that would be figurative, not literal. And I dropped down into this place, and everyone around me was completely disconnected, absolutely uninterested in each other, like nobody else existed. And a lot of them were mumbling, as some of them were just shouting out, crying and saying things like, "If only you had done this or that, then I wouldn't have had to take my life." Like in this moment of blame. This darkness was about waist deep, but it had this almost a crackling energy about it, and it started to suck the life out of me, is about the only words I've got for it. And it was almost like there was a race going on that I needed to get the rest of this near-death experience in order to choose back into my body before this darkness had just robbed from me every willingness to live. So I'm looking down at this man, and nobody's really paying attention to each other. And I'm looking down, and there's this man, and he's squatting down, and he's looking at me. I know that he has blue eyes, even though I'm seeing in grayscale. I know I'm seeing in grayscale, and I know he has blue eyes. I know he's been there a long time. I think it's about 2,000 years, which that means nothing, by the way. Time doesn't mean anything. That was my own thought. At the same time, before I tell you about that, there was a vanity that was off to my right, and it was crackling in and out of existence. I could see through it. I could see that the drawers were empty. It was like an early American vanity, and I knew it was there for me. And then there was a school chair, a small school chair made of wood and steel, and it was crackling in and out of existence, almost like if you are somebody who sees deceased people, kind of like that. And I knew it wasn't there for me. Okay? So then I'm looking at this man, and I have this thought. I wonder if this is Judas Iscariot, which came from me, not from him. But that was a testimony. That was a testament that I believed in a Christ. In that moment, and the rest of this happened very, very quickly, much of it at the same time, I see a pinpoint of light in the distance, like a star. At the same time, I hear a voice, and it's booming like thunder, but not loud. And all of this darkness around me starts to reverberate, like vibrate. And he says, "Is this what you really want?" And I see this light coming towards me at tremendous speed. And I say, "But my life is so hard." And as he approaches, I can see that it's like in the figure of a man. And I've never seen anything more beautiful in my life. He's made of light. His robes are flowing. His hair is flowing. And the energy, this darkness, is all vibrating. "This is God. This is God. This is God. This is God." Kind of like the fish in Finding Nemo, where they're all, it's one big fish made of all those little fish, and they're one. Or like Jumanji, where the monkeys are all jumping in the kitchen like this, and then they're going like this. Do you know what I'm talking about? It was like one. And I said, "But my life is so hard." And then he said, "You think it's hard now?" And he didn't have to complete anything, and this is all kind of telepathic communication. The rest of that was, "It doesn't compare to what happens to you if you take your life." And he says, "We've all done this. You can't skip over parts. It's supposed to be hard. This is the worst thing you could have done. I told you how to do this." And then I remembered a moment when I was having a conversation with a bishop, pastor, you know, evangelical leader who I was counseling with, and I was just in tears and said, "Tell me how to get through this." And this was a couple years earlier. And he said, "If I tell you, then you have to do it." And I said, "Of course, of course." And of course I didn't do it. But he said, "Pray and read your scriptures." And then he said that you've been a tremendous tool for evil. You don't deserve your kids. And all of this wasn't like harsh, like God is not like this. He is like my father. What parent sits back and lets their child do something that they aren't upset with them about it? It was like that, like this very loving, get your act together kind of conversation. And then I just stood there kind of dumbfounded. I could not believe that this was happening. I couldn't believe that I was important enough that I had God standing before me. Then I heard another voice, and it was the same voice that was next to me during my life review. And he says, "Don't you understand? I did this for you." And I can tell that there's another being next to God. And when he says that, I can start to see pinpricks of light coming through this darkness, like if you were to poke holes in a piece of construction paper up against the light, and I realize that there's some kind of a barrier that I can't see through. And when he says that, several things happened at once. I was taken to multiple points of view. I was taken behind them, and I could see Christ and God communicating, and Christ pretty much just downloaded my life into God. It was this exchange of light and understanding, communication. It was perfect and it was instantaneous until they were one. Their voice was one, their thoughts were one, as if they were one. And at the same time, I could see myself in this dark realm watching them. At the same time, I was taken into Christ's body in the Garden of Gethsemane, and I experienced him experiencing my life from beginning to end as if it was his own. And in that moment, I knew somebody else got what I'd been through, like as if it was his own life. And I still wasn't willing to come back. I still didn't think I could do this. And so then I was shown what would happen to my children. My oldest boy, I saw his life first, but what I saw was like this emotional roller coaster of his life, not necessarily all the details And so I saw like his life, like this roller coaster of his life, this emotional roller coaster. And he came to be about 20 years old. And he was dead, like the kid that was standing next to me during my life review. He was rendered completely incapable of doing a single thing he was meant to do here. He was just empty and void of happiness, of light, because I had done this thing. And then my second child, he got to be about 7 or 8 years old, and he was taken, because he could not do this without me. So I said, the tiniest little smidge of, okay, like really, I don't think I even got even the thought complete, okay. And then I was up out of there, and I was above this realm, and I could see below me, I could see all these other people just kind of almost like sleepwalking, drifting down into this place, and I was surrounded by angels, and they were just whipping past me at such speed that I could hardly make out their forms. And I said, what is this? And then I heard a voice say, they're helping you, they always have been. Among a lot of other things, I was just downloaded, just packed this suitcase of everything I needed to know. I was told it is small things that we do that make the biggest difference. I've shown how the union of a man and a woman creates a whole, like a marriage, you know, because what a lot of what I was dealing with was a marriage that wasn't working. So, like, not for all of y'all, but I mean, just in general, my marriage wasn't working, and that there was this imbalance between the female and the male power there. It's a whole when you put them together. But I had complete compassion for him and complete understanding. He was just dealing with what he was dealing with. And I was in victim dance. And I really got like, I'm responsible for how this is going. Not to blame, but responsible. There was a lot that I was given that I wasn't permitted to bring back with me. A lot that was for me alone. Not like I can't share it with y'all, but like pertained to my life at the time that I don't even have words for. Much of it was just like this experiential thing. And then I went back into my body, and as I opened my eyes, I could feel the drugs that I had taken. And so I swung my legs down, and I sat up on the couch, and my husband was coming through the front door, and this must have been about 11 o'clock in the morning, and like I said, they don't come home for lunch, right? The first thing I notice when the door swings open is the sunlight coming through that door, that it doesn't have the same ordinary qualities of light, like what I was accustomed to, that I was seeing depth and breadth and elements and light that I had not seen previously. I could see the love coming through the front door. I could see the purity. I could see complete acceptance. I could see the gift coming through the front door. And so he's in shadow and he's coming down the hallway and he sits down on the love seat. And I'm just sitting up, looking around, amazed. My house plants were like light. They were light. The leaves were like this light, made of light. I could see like this. I could see the couch. I could see the molecules that formed my couch vibrating. We are couch serving you, serving God. We are pillow serving you, serving God. We are floor serving you, serving God. We are table serving you, serving God. On my TV, I could see all the communication that had come through it, that made of darkness and that made of light. I could see all the communication that would come through it. Like it was just like right there on the screen. And I looked at my husband and I said, you are never going to believe this. And he goes, I think I might. And so I shared the experience with him. And then I continued to hear. It's like the door didn't close. I could still hear God speaking to me. So my husband was like, well, we better get you to the emergency room. And I'm being told, don't do that. I brought you back to life. What else do you want? They're going to ship you off to Hickam Air Force Base, which is where the psych ward is. You don't need to do that. You need to stay home with your family right now. And so I just had to sweat out the drugs. And so I have these lovely pictures from my birthday 2 days later, my 27th birthday. So Ricky was what, 5 years old? So when he was about 20, he was seeing a little girl I didn't like very much, if I'm straight about it. And we lived in Idaho at the time, and we drove down to go visit a grown daughter of mine. I now have 6 kids, by the way, and 6 grandchildren. And we drove down to go visit my daughter and her kids and her husband. And at some point, my debit card quit working. I thought, oh, it's okay. I just forgot to call the bank and tell them I was traveling, and I get home. It's 2 o'clock in the morning, and I'm opening the mail, and Ricky is standing in front of my piano about 5 feet from me, and I open my bank statement, And he and his little girlfriend took out $1,000 in a week, except for the days they took out $2,000. So they cleaned me out $10,000 in 1 week's time. And I look up at him. I say, what did you do? And it's the moment from my near-death experience. It's the moment I saw him. And I hear a voice say, give him your coat also. So I said, I can't talk to you about this right now. I'm going to kill you. We'll talk in the morning. He left in a huff and went on a little Ricky bench for a little while, 3 months. I didn't see him for a little while. I sold his tires. He had some rims that he was selling in my garage, and I'd had a garage sale, and I sold them. So I called him. I said, you need to come get your money. And he's like, okay, are you sure? And so he comes to get his money, but I'm not home. So he calls me on the phone and says, I'm here and you're not here. I said, well, go get your money. It's in my tin with the rest of my money on my dresser. And he says, you trust me to do that? I said, what's trust? What is that? You're going to do what you're going to do, and I'm going to love you anyway. So what? Yes, go get your money, please. And so that was it. And he married her. And I have got these three amazing grandchildren. And my daughter-in-law's like my child. I love that girl. We have matching bathing suits. They're teal with white polka dots that cover our birthing hips, both of us. And Charlie... we really stressed when I really had a rough year there when he was turning 7 to 8. And that was about the time Beyond the Darkness came out, too. Anyway, he's still kicking it in my basement. And he's my troublemaker, but he's a lot of fun. He's the one that's like me. We have extraordinary relationships. So now I'm going to circle back. So we moved here, would have been 07. And I'm a writer. You know, besides that I wrote Beyond the Darkness, I also write. And I was working on a book with a LeBaron, a former LeBaron polygamist. And I tell stories. I partner with people who have incredible stories to tell about love, forgiveness, power, peace, choice in the face of impossible circumstances. So I'm partnered with this woman that was a LeBaron. I don't know if you know the LeBaron polygamist. Her uncle, Ervil, killed like 37 people or something. Her ex-husband was dating Rebecca Lafferty, who is Dan Lafferty's oldest daughter. And we didn't put this all together. I just get a text from her one day. She's at the bookstore, and she's bumped into Rebecca. So Angela is her name. She shoots me a text. She goes, guess who I'm with? I said, who? She goes, Rebecca Lafferty. And I text back. I don't even finish reading the text. I said, I need to meet with her. And then I read the rest of the text and it says, she needs to meet with you. And so I met with her. I think it was actually that night. Hardly anything was said. Just, hi, Rebecca, nice to meet you. Come sit down. We sit down on the couch and she looks at me. And it's like we've known each other for a million years. And she says, you're going to give me healing around my dad. I said, then we're going to write your story. It's been 7 years, and we're negotiating a book deal now, and we've been writing this story. Who knew that that moment that propelled me into victim advocacy work, that brought up everything, that had me attempt suicide, would circle all the way back around? There came a point where I knew I was going to have to meet Dan Lafferty in order to interview him. And so I've been visiting him in prison for 3 years. And Rebecca and I made an agreement. She was going to do all she needed to do to heal. She was going to let all of it come up. All of the shame for the love that she had that she kept for her father. All of the pain, everything, come up and deal with it. And I was going to be blank canvas. I was not going to bring one brush stroke of judgment. I was just going to go and meet with him and listen and be forgiveness from all daughters. And he's beginning, you know, for 30 years he's been saying God told him to do that. And I can't say sorry because I'll offend God. Because he believes he's Elijah. You know, he's like an Abraham. Like God would command a man to go kill. And he's been shifting. And he's actually reached out to Rebecca now and asked for her forgiveness. Apologized to her for what her life has been like because of it. Now, what I do is I empower other writers. I run in writers' conferences. I write full time. And it's a miracle he shows up. So that's it. There you go.
Angie, I'm just wondering,
yes.
Approximately how long was this experience? Do you recall from when you first took the drugs and when how long it might have been? Is there any way to...
There is no way to know because time is not measured the same way. When you cross over, it's not the same. It could have been 10,000 years, and it could have been 5 minutes, and it would make no difference.
And I guess I'm just asking, do you know what time you took those drugs?
Oh, what time it happened,
yeah.
And how long I was actually gone in physical reality? I don't.
Okay.
I don't.
Thank you.
I'm guessing that it was about 5 minutes, but that's a guess.
Some say that in the pre-existence that we chose our life experiences so that we would grow spiritually. If so, why did you choose a hard life like this?
I'm so glad you asked that. So I was the first near-death experiencer to actually share about an experience that went like mine did. There were three things that happened in 1 week's time. When we came back from Okinawa, we moved to Washington State, and I was a big Nirvana fan. Kurt Cobain was a Seattleite. When I was still in Okinawa, I told very few people about my near-death experience. My best friend knew. She sent me Betty Eady's book, and when I read it, I knew I was going to meet her. Like, I know, no, yeah, of course. So I came back to the States, and it was a hard adjustment because Okinawa was just heaven. Nobody was rude to me for 3 whole years, not once in 3 years. I had watched Thelma and Louise on TV, and they drive off a cliff at the end. For some reason, it struck me like it was my mother and my sister, and I went upstairs and I sobbed for 2 hours. I don't know what was wrong with me. Dr. Kevorkian was in the news. He was the suicide assist doctor. He was on trial, so that was all over the headlines, and I had a newspaper that came with Dr. Kevorkian on the front page. We lived in the foothills of the Cascades. It was gorgeous, but it's this little small town on a little lake, and I would drive into Redmond or Bellevue to do my grocery shopping once a week. And it was one of those lovely days, rare lovely days, where you can have the window down in Seattle. So I'm in Redmond doing my grocery shopping. I'm in the car, and I'm listening to the radio, and I've got my window down. And at the same time that a vanload of teenagers drives past me, I'm hearing the announcer say they found Kurt Cobain's body. And there's all these teenagers hanging out the windows of this van, and they're all crying, "My hero's dead." And I knew that there would be kids that would take their lives. Not I'm guessing, I knew. I saw it. So I got on my knees and I said, "What can I do?" And I hear God tell me, "You could write a book." I said, "Yes, I could do that." So I open the phone book and I look up Betty Eady, and of all things, she's still in the phone book. She was at the time the number one New York Times bestseller and had been for 6 months, but we didn't have new phone books, and this is back when you had phone books, right? And I call the number and I say, "I don't know why I'm calling you. I'm just supposed to." And her son answers the phone. They've transferred it to a literary agency, and I'm their first call. And I tell him briefly in like a minute about my experience, and he says, "We've been waiting for your call." And within 3 days, he had that sold to Bantam, and it was on the shelves in Barnes & Noble worldwide 4 months later. That was 20 years ago. I get email, I get calls from people every day who didn't kill themselves because I chose back in, and I got courageous and I wrote that book. That was the scariest thing I did in my life up to that point. And I'm kind of a thrill seeker, if you haven't noticed. My kid's soccer coach, school principal, was going to know that I attempted suicide. That terrified me. That would be one reason, is that, you know, my message is still out there. People can, when something's in print, it's eternal. And people can read it and read it and read it and read it. I got a call from a 16-year-old kid in Virginia a couple weeks ago. And they all have the same tonal quality in their voice. And he's like, "I got no other resources here. You're my last shot at staying alive." And I actually got on the internet and made myself a reverend, put it in my shopping cart and paid for it on PayPal so that I could counsel a minor in "Don't do that with your life" and be protected by laws that clergy are protected by. I don't even know how many thousands of people have reached out to me and said that they didn't because I did and came back because I chose back in. And you should know there's a suicide prevention walk at WSU on the 4th. Like 8 a.m. till 2, and I'm speaking, and a friend of mine, Wendy Parmley, who lost her mother to suicide when she was 12 years old, she wrote Hope After Suicide, One Woman's Journey from Darkness to Light, and she and I are both speaking there as well.
You say you went to purgatory when you committed suicide. I'm LDS Mormon, but I've studied what other principal churches in America believe and what the principal world religions believe. They all believe that suicide is a sin. What I wanted to know is, according to the Roman Catholics' doctrine, purgatory is where people are purged or freed from the sin or nature that prevents them from going
That's
to
great. You know, I've heaven. Never heard that. That actually makes sense to
and
me.
And is the Roman Catholic purgatory roughly equal to the LDS Mormon spirit prison, where we believe
yeah.
that those,
I have
it's
no
a school.
Idea. Yeah, I have no idea. But that was my experience of
right
the place.
To prepare ourselves for heaven.
Here's what I took away from the experience. It was a way station in order to get the impact for what I'd done to others. Not like you're in trouble, not like you're being punished, but like to get the gravity, to get the impact, to get what I could do in the world, to be accountable, responsible for that. Not like blame, not like fault, not like shame, not like that, but be responsible and own it and take responsibility for how those actions, the ripple effect. The way I saw the ripple effect, I saw this when I was on my way back. It was shown to me like a dandelion. Like if you blow one dandelion, it has the power to populate your whole yard in a week. Another week, and it's the whole street. Like one dandelion has the power to populate the whole globe. And that's what our words are like. That's how our actions are. We have no idea. Like if we could see our language, I'm telling you, we would mind our tongues. And not like, ooh, I can't say that, but like, really, we would acknowledge people, we would acknowledge our parents, we would acknowledge our children, we would take responsibility for the words that come out of our mouth.
You're describing an experience where you're in this darkness, and the darkness actually has a physical capacity. It has like a physical weight or some kind of, you can feel it.
I'd say it has mass. But you know what? I am not a physicist. I'm not a scientist.
Yeah.
So I know I don't explain this in correct terminology.
It's okay. Whatever you say, it makes sense to me. But as the darkness was there and then you saw God coming, you said that it was recognizing that it was actually shaking all the darkness
yes.
around you.
Yes.
And there were other people in that darkness too. Did you sense that those other people also sensed the light coming? And
good question. No, they didn't. They didn't even notice. And in fact, the man squatting, when I was on the other side watching God and Christ communicating and I could see myself, he was squatting looking at me, looking out, looking at me, like back and forth, like trying to figure out what I was looking at. But that doesn't mean that nobody does. I don't think that they're just communicating to themselves. When I go stay someplace haunted, I have extraordinary experiences. They know me. They know I can see them. They know I can talk to them. So they communicate with me. Those experiences are very similar to how those people were behaving in that dark realm. I have my own interpretation of it. I wouldn't call it fact. Who knows? But I think that what's going on is they're stuck in a moment. And until they have the experience of being appreciated and gotten and take responsibility for what they did, like that releases them. Because I refuse to believe that I'm the only one that God would release. Something else I want to say about that. I have two friends, one who lost her son to suicide and one who lost her brother. In fact, it's my other writing partner, my other co-author, who's the Liberian. She lost her brother to suicide. In both of those cases, their deceased loved ones have come back and said, I'm good. I'm in a good place. My inclination is to say that is not a permanent state. That is not. It's time out. And then something else about that, too, is everybody wants to know, well, I lost so-and-so to suicide. What should I do? Your prayers make all the difference. You have no idea how powerful prayer is. So two things, pray for them and forgive them. And that helps to facilitate on our side of the veil.
Angie, either at the time or subsequently, have you gained any insights as to a net difference between those who commit suicide out of despondency and those who might either go off life support or actively end their life in a terminal situation?
Something I came back with is I'm unwilling to judge, period. I'm so clear I'm not the judge, and neither are we. It's between each individual and God, and I have no idea what happens to everybody else who commits suicide. I know that there were people there. I know that's where I went. I know that there were teenagers that didn't go where I went. I don't have an answer for you about that. I personally will never do that again. If I get cancer and I struggle with it for 10 years, I'm going to have a rockin' life. That's how I'm going to live my life. I live my life hands in the air. Like, no joke. I'll take on anything and everything from a powerful place, from an empowering place, from a place where I am going to make all the difference I can make on this planet for every breath that comes in and out. I personally would not opt for that, and I think it's dangerous. I do. That is my opinion. That is not from the near-death experience.
Why do you think suicide is on the rise among teens?
Here's what I think. When we stop being connected to each other, that's when we start relating to ourselves like we are islands and like we're not connected. Different societies have different rates of suicide, and it goes up and it goes down. I think it's up in Utah quite a bit. The last stat I heard is that we actually have a high rate of suicide among our elders. But it's that experience of being disconnected, ultimately. And we're connected, we're one. It's like you have a physical body, so you have the experience of being separate. And you have that spirit that inhabits your physical body and matches form that you take with you when you pass over. But you also have an energetic body. This is science. And that energy that we are is one. It is connected. We are connected. And you're breathing the same air that has the same water molecules in it that have been on this planet from the beginning of time. You're breathing air that was breathed in China 2,000 years ago. You want to tell me genetically you aren't Chinese too? We are physically one. We are spiritually one.
Were you able to see what God and Jesus looked like?
Mm-hmm. There's a rendering of Christ. He's in a red robe. I think it's an LDS picture, I'm not sure. That was the closest rendering I've seen. That was my experience of him. When I saw that picture, I was like, that's what he looks like. God, one of the things I was shocked by was that I had a bump on the bridge of my nose like this, and so did he. I look just exactly like my mother, okay? She has a bump on the bridge of her nose too. And when I was 11, I saw her again for the first time in a long time, and she had this tape across her nose and black eyes, and I said, what happened? And she says, oh, I got a nose job. And in that moment, I made it mean my nose is the wrong nose, right? So that's, you know, kind of funny to be dead and to be fixated, like, I'm literally created in your image. Like, I look like you. He had a rounded widow's peak, white, flowing hair. I read a near-death experience from a child once and said, God looks like an old man without wrinkles. That would be about the most accurate, like, fit, perfect.
You talk about forgiving all the people that kind of hurt you in your life.
Mm-hmm.
Can you kind of explain the process or how that worked? Was it just yep. because of the love of Jesus and God, or was there more?
Your access. If you're having a hard time forgiving anybody, pick the person that's hardest for you to forgive in your life. Picture them right now, what they did to you. Get in their shoes. Be in their shoes. Be in their life. We can't judge until we've experienced every moment of that life with that DNA, with the upbringing, with everything. And then every moment that happened to that person where they made stuff mean stuff that it didn't mean, that's your access. And you can't hang on to it if you're willing to get in their shoes all the way. And it takes something, because here's what holds us back from that. We want to be certain that we're right about it, that they offended us. We're really glued to that. We're invested. And once you're willing to just acknowledge, like, maybe I don't know everything, then you can have compassion and forgiveness, just the natural outcome.
And the comment that I have is from coming a lot and reading a lot. My bottom line on near-death experiences is that when you have one, you get what you need. So perhaps somebody from Okinawa who dies, they're not going to see the same God or Jesus Christ that you saw.
Oh, gotcha. So I will be the first to tell you, whatever religion works for you, get on that horse and ride it. I go to Diksha. I have received the Tao at the Taiwanese Buddhist temple. I go to my LDS ward. I'm really interested in attending Catholic Mass with a friend of mine. I just love to be in the space of worship with other people. It's amazing to me. Like, I'm just blown away what people will give their lives to. And that just rocks. And I don't know. I have no idea. We'll all find out. You guys all get a near-death experience too. I just got two of them.
When we die. But I know, just being in the space, but I think that we all, whenever we agree to our life or however that works, that we we knew that if we got to go to the other side, it would be like a little catch-up session or something. And I remember you said this, and so go back and you got to work on that. But anyway, that's the gospel according to Janet. So.
I live in such a place now, there's no lid. I'm not willing to put a lid on what I can learn and be with. And, you know, especially writing Rebecca Lafferty's story, it became our intertwining stories. I really resisted that for a long time. We have days where we have like 12 miracles in a day that are just probability-wise impossible. And knowing is the lid. The moment you're certain about something, you're done learning about it.
Thank you for sharing your story. Mm-hmm. It gives a lot of hope and understanding. So, I wondered about June and January, what that was for you.
Oh.
And you said you had trouble.
Yeah. So I would go nuts. I would do things that were like I can't even talk about in a mixed crowd. And I would be completely beyond depressed. I would just hole up in my bedroom, in my bed, and just curl up under the covers. It still hit me after the near-death experience, but I didn't act on it. And then it was about 3 years later, I was feeling it coming on. The book was getting ready to be released. It was in June, just before the book's release, so it had been June of 94. And I lived on this little lake, and I was walking around the lake. It was a two-mile walk around this lake. And I was just talking to God, and I could feel it coming. And I was just praying, I don't know what to do about this. And I heard him say, the truth will make you free. And in that moment, I took responsibility. I'm doing the things I'm doing because I want to hurt my husband because I hate him. And the minute I told the truth like that, it was gone and I never dealt with it again. And then I got to deal powerfully with my husband and say, look, this isn't working for me. And we are friends to this day. We were divorced a couple years later. And I stopped like allowing him to do his garbage too, to run his garbage as well. And I've never dealt with it again. Like every now and then, I'll have kind of a shadow of it. My brain will do this funny thing. It's like, it's just brain activity. I'm not related to it emotionally at all. It's not like that. It's like, oh, okay, that was an interesting thought. Thank you. Bye. Like, no hook. None. I would never even entertain it for a second.
I have a quick question. You gave us some good context about your life prior to the event, and then it seems like afterwards you've really become a lot more spiritual. Can you give us a little insight as to how were you spiritual before this happened, or irrespective of religious doctrine, but
so disconnected from it.
Okay.
And I really believed there was some kind of a weird fluke in the cosmos, and I should have been born a fish or something. I really did believe that I was not worthy to inhabit this planet with you human beings. So I would say I had a disempowering view of God and spirituality, but I was spiritual. I just kind of lost myself.
For depression, there are lots of pharmaceutical drugs that are prescribed. Do you have any opinion about the pharmaceutical drugs that are provided to people who have severe depression?
I would say don't kill yourself. Whatever you got to do to not do that, do that. And I don't ever tell anybody, don't seek the advice of a physician. Do whatever works for you, but get help. Whatever you do, get help. Not tell Suzanne Summers, you're wrong to take care of your cancer by laughing.
You don't have anything against the medical profession?
No.
Okay.
No, I don't. In fact, I'll tell you, when after I was married to my second husband, I caught him having an affair after I had a baby, and I took Zoloft for a year.
So, Angie?
Hi!
Hi! I'm dying to know. So, you had two boys. How many grandkids?
Six.
Oh, that's awesome.
I know,
that's wonderful. I have a comment, but it's also a question because I want to hear your confirmation or what you think of it. In my studies throughout the years on near-death experience and research, one of the things I came to understand, having been close to suicide a few times, questions that had been asked during near-death experiences by these people were answered either by this being of Christ or a guide or someone. I'm telling you, kind of like I've put it all together and this is what I came out with. George Ritchie, you know My Descent into Heaven? Okay, when he had an opportunity during his near-death experience, he asked the Savior, why were the Jews ever burned in those incinerators in Auschwitz and so on? And it was the same understanding I have about even suicide, and that was he was told that they would be glorified, the people who were submitted to that. But then he wanted to know, what about Hitler? And this was the part that blew me away. He understood that hell really is living in the eternities, in the afterlife, with the recognition of all the pain that you had caused others. And unless you had asked forgiveness, as long as there was a person on earth that had suffered because of what you had done, you would be in pain. I love what you said about forgiveness. If you've lost someone, even if you didn't lose them to suicide, and you're holding on to the anger, mm-hmm. it is affecting them. And that's what I understood. They can be released through that Lord's forgiveness, but yeah, to get there.
If you want the world to change, if you want a world where there is no more war, where there is no more sex trade slavery, where there is no more brutality, you forgive.
Yeah.
That's our access.
And part of the thing about the suicide was not just others forgiving them, but the person forgiving themselves.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. See, I want to know if I'm on the right track after all this.
Yeah, blow past that, because it's like I hardly even need to forgive anybody, you know, because it's just automatic. You know, there are a few I hang on to until I'm tired of being a brat.
Sometimes memories come back, and you have to re-forgive.
Here's what it is. It's like choice. It's not something that you do once and that it's done. You choose, and you choose, and you choose, and every day you forgive, and you forgive, and you forgive. You can lose that connection to light that you have from that original forgiveness. Like, I do forgive my father on regular. You know, that was something that I got out of writing this, The Sparrow's Lens, was forgiveness for my father. And we had this conversation on his deathbed. He said, "Ange, I'm not a child molester." I said, "Dad, look at me. I turned out, didn't I? Look at me. Look who you raised. We're good." And then he was gone. There's so many levels to this. It's like washing that blouse that's dry clean. It's not dry clean only. You could dry clean it or you could wash it. And you've sent it to the dry cleaner for years, and then you decide you're going to hand wash it because you're in a hurry. And you could like wash it in that sink. You pull it out and it's like filthy, drain it, do it again, filthy, drain it, do it again, filthy, drain it. Like that.
Thank you, Angie, for your experience and sharing that with us. When you're experiencing the telepathy, and even in that dark, dark place, other people could feel your thoughts. But when it went into the brighter side, mm-hmm. when you expressed that they were communicating with each other.
God and Christ or Heavenly Father.
Beings that were there. One question... And I probably picked that up in your how you talked about the thought processes and the telepathy that was going on. Was it like home in that process? Wasn't it more communication-wise, could be more expressed?
While they were communicating?
Uh-huh.
I was blown away. I was just, I cannot believe this is happening. That's where I was. I was really dumbstruck, jaw-dropped. That's how I was.
And then some of the things that were being said would be hard for you to express what all was being said.
Yeah, there are some things I just don't even have words for. There's just no human language. It would do it disservice, you know, to try to, like, to describe Christ and that love and that perfection. It's like he's not some deity, bow down, worship me. Not like that at all. It's like my brother. So much love, so much perfect love, that I have no words.
Do you think your near-death experience was part of your life plan, or did you make lemonade out of it?
Well, I'll tell you recently, and this can't leave this room, okay, because I'm in book deal negotiations now. You can talk about it after the book comes out. Okay, so one of the things that I was dealing with when I was writing The Sparrow's Lens was how is Brenda's family, she was the victim, her and her baby, how are they going to respond to this book? But it's all about healing, but still, there was a point, I was driving through, my grown kids live in Idaho now. I was driving through a torrential downpour last summer, and I pulled off to get gas near Twin Falls. It was the Kimberly exit, and it was just pounding rain. 2 o'clock in the morning, I had a headlight out, and so I decided to take the back road. And the whole time, I'm like feeling like this pecking at me, Kimberly, Kimberly, why is this important? Kimberly, pay attention. And then I get to the end of Kimberly Road, where the turnoff is to Twin Falls, and there's a cemetery on the right and a cemetery on the left. And it just clicks. Brenda and Erica are buried here. And so I stayed a couple days, and I went and I sat on their graves. I bought a little charm, a little angel wing with another one inside, and I put it in a medicine bottle, sealed it up in Ziploc baggie, put it in the medicine bottle with a note. And I said, "Dear Brenda and Erica, I don't know what I'm doing. You're with God. Help me here. I'm the scribe. Give me the words." And I tucked it in there. I buried it at the crease at the grave, and I sat there. All of a sudden, they appeared behind me, and they were holding hands, and they were just light, angel-level light in white, about 25 years old, both of them. And Brenda says, "Enjoy your children. Love your life. Be kind. Be grateful. Be fearless. You're on your path. You couldn't mess this up if you tried." That's it. That's really, that says it all. And I'm not saying there is no choice. It's all choice. And if that's your path and that's what you're going to do for your trip here, it's for your good. Or this path, it's for your good. And it eventually all comes back somewhere in the eternities, because our God is a loving God. And he honors our choice, and he honors us.
So what about hypocrisy? What about those individuals who pretend to be good, but deep down inside, they're just vicious?
Let me ask you guys, what do you think I'm going to say? Good, forgive. Forgive, because that's the closest link to actually changing their hearts, when you forgive. If you've got to have a reason, have it be that. So forgive, 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 and
will
love.
Will that change them?
I don't mean tolerate. I'm the last person that tolerates anything. I'll be the first one to say, "No, that doesn't work. Not on my watch. We're not doing that. I'm sorry. We're changing laws."
This experience opened you up to actually see God and Jesus Christ. And so that is the good. Much of that good side was revealed, but in that too, we know there is opposition in all things. Mm-hmm. Do you experience more sensing of not good and evil around you? And if so, how is it that you protect your being and yourself? What kind of field do you put around yourself?
Right, because you're talking to the girl that goes visits murderers in prison. It's no fear. I don't fear. And I just radiate light. I live light, I am light, I'm authentic, I tell the truth, I clean it up. If I make a mess, if I hurt somebody's feelings, I tell them I'm sorry, and I rectify it, and then I don't fear. And there's no power. Darkness would feed on fear.
You mentioned something in your talk about Jesus telling you that life is to be hard. Makes me question, especially in contrast with Anita Morjani's experience, and she
right.
talks about exactly the opposite. Life isn't meant to be hard. It's meant to be pleasant and easy.
So I have an interpretation of that. Those were the words that I heard. It's supposed to be hard. And I don't think like it's supposed to be suffering. I think it means it's supposed to work you out. You don't come out of this experience flabby.
Like going to the gym.
Yeah. It's a workout. But suffering is self-imposed. Like, I've been through some stuff, like, since then. And I just can't hang on to it. I gotta let it go. Otherwise, I'm wasting my time.
Thank you for coming.